This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the July 28th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm joined by Lonnie Goldfeder to my left in the studio, and remote from Saratoga, we have Mr. Pete Fornatel. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, how are you?
How are you doing on this the lone dark day of the week now that Saratoga is back in session?
Thankfully, the lone dark
day. You needed a break?
I need a break already.
you needed a break from the All Bill Mott weekend?
The all Bill Mott unexpected weekend, yeah. That's right. Yeah, doing things he's never done before.
Yeah, Pete, what was your big takeaway from this first weekend at the elongated first weekend at Saratoga?
I was really impressed by how crazy the plant was on both Friday and Saturday. It was 3 and 4 deep at the Paddock Bar, and from my brief walking around the place, I mean, I believe the 30,000 number from opening day. It seems like Saratoga opening day is taking on a little more of that sort of Del Mar vibe, where it becomes this sort of party central for people in the region, which was really cool. It was just great to be back up there. The heat was a little much. I think it's going to be a lot much this week, but I think we saw some really interesting racing, and you know, I'm so happy to be up here and have a chance to talk about all this cool stuff for the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, me too. Well, we had 4 public handicapper races. We had one that we won't really talk about too much, the Fleet Treat State Bred Sprint on the dirt. Favorite finished second or third, I can't even remember, to the second choice. None of us had it. That's okay. We tried to take a shot with a price, and that's what happens sometimes. But we do want to dive into the other ones, the Diana, the San Diego Handicap, the Sanford, and then we also should talk about the Coaching Club American Oaks on Sunday at Saratoga. So with that, let's dive into the Diana. It was a grade one on the turf. It was a race where the pace setters kind of ran off from the pack, and Hard Not to Like got up just in the shadow of the wire. I guess you could say a perfectly timed ride by John Velasquez, and I heard him on the Bick show yesterday saying he thinks he almost waited a little too long. So,
ironically, he was like the only one who went. I mean, the bottom line was you had all these other closers like Stephanie's Kitten and Waltzing Matilda and Lady Lara, and the only one making a move was John Velasquez. It's funny because, you know, these 2 horses were loose, and you've got everybody else who's basically a closer.
There's
in
3
the
horses
yeah,
were loose.
Yeah, they were loose, but then Hard Not to Like makes the first move. The other guys don't make a move, and you're wondering, you know, if particularly those people sitting on the favorite Stephanie's Kitten, when is she going to move?
Yeah,
but again, Velasquez times it right. He makes the first move. He gets good run. He gets good clear run, and he's got plenty of horse at the end to just get up there for the win.
Yeah, well, on the podcast, I had made the case that I thought that the pace scenario, I certainly didn't think they were going to be that clear of the rest of the field, but I thought that the pace scenario might be hot, and I thought that Hard Not to Like might get the first run on the deeper closers, and then I was just hoping she would hold on, but those ones on the front end ended up running the rest of the pack off their heels a bit, and really Hard Not to Like was the only one that was able to close any ground late. Pete, what was your takeaway from that race?
I thought it was just an unbelievable bit of riding by John Velasquez. I don't think it's a coincidence that the closers behind him didn't fire or weren't able to really ever get into the race, because I think he set them up for failure by dropping anchor on Hard Not to Like while that speed duel was going on. So all of a sudden you have a situation where the deeper closers were just too far out of it to ever make a run, and he was sort of there, the only one in touch enough to make a run. Now, granted, by as much as he won by in the end, I can understand why he said what he said about maybe he waited too long. But I think in reality, he just rode it perfectly. She was loaded. And you have to figure, I'm not saying he rode the race any differently for being taken off Stephanie's Kitten, but you have to say that victory was probably a little extra sweet for Mr. Velasquez. And that, to me, was one of the big stories of opening weekend was, hey, it's the John Velasquez show, and a little bit of a reminder that he was still at a point in his life where he felt like riding 8 or 9 a day, he'd still be the leading rider up here every year.
It also shows you why John Velasquez and the higher profile jockeys dominate that meet. It's really jockeys do make a difference at Saratoga, and the first week is a very good example as to why. They, you know, it's a big transition from Belmont. I mean, even if you have a fuller field, you're at a real much tighter turns, much smaller racetrack, and you really have to get a good you have to get in good position. And jockeys are making a big difference. At least that first weekend, they really, mm-hmm. really did. Mm-hmm. I saw too many guys get stuck in traffic. Too many guys missed the break. Either the pressure was getting to them, or they just couldn't deal with the traffic. But there was a lot of issues where good rides made a lot of difference in these races this past weekend, and that was a perfect example.
Yeah, and I would imagine a jockey like Julien Leperoux has to feel a little snake bit at Saratoga. I think he's sitting on 5 wins from about 100 starts in the last two meets plus 4 days. So and certainly he rode Tepin as well as he could with that hot pace, got her in a position that she could win, and just ended up getting nosed out at the wire. It was a fantastic race. And then from a wagering standpoint, on the podcast, I had thought that Hard Not to Like might get a little overlooked in the wagering with the 3 big choices. I certainly didn't expect Hard Not to Like to be the 5th choice.
Well, you also came up with that very good formulator stat. I mean, he had the formulator stat when Velasquez is with the trainer. And that's outstanding. That's the one reason.
That was the cherry on top.
But that's one reason. Like if you're on the fence, it's certainly a reason to put him on a ticket.
Right.
You know.
Right, and I like to look at those kinds of things to just try and figure out trainer intent when they're making a jock switch. Mm-hmm. Is this a positive or negative one in terms of what they've done in the past with certain riders? And when you see, well, now Christophe Clement, Johnny V together in turf route graded stakes over the last year, they're now, 9-4-12. Right. So, not bad.
And he's 4-55 with everybody else, just in case you missed that. Okay.
Right, yeah, thanks for the reminder.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to the San Diego Handicap. It was Saturday late afternoon on the West Coast, evening for us on the East Coast. It was billed, I guess, as the return for Byron to 2 turns, return for Byron to Southern California. He went off as your relatively strong favorite. I don't know what it was in the end. It was 6-5, 7-5, I think. I think, boy, he ran a solid race. I think he certainly ran an improved race. I wonder if it was the Byron of 2014, if he would have won, or if he still maybe needed that race in order to move forward, considering it's the first time he's gone 2 turns since he won, certainly in a controversial manner, the Breeders' Cup Classic back in the beginning of November last year. Pete, what was your take on the race?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Byron for the charitable donation I'm going to make to various equine charities, thanks to some folks thinking he actually had a chance to win that race, which I certainly did not. I just don't think he's a horse anymore. I think, I loved his Woody Stevens. I think a lot of his form since is a mirage. It's a product of easy leads, biased racetracks, and racking up half the field at the start of the Breeders' Cup Classic. I'm eager for this horse to retire.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. He's game on due too. Although Game On Dude's actually passed a couple of horses.
Game On Dude was a good horse, though.
I was going to say, Game On Dude actually passed a couple of horses, so he might not even be at that level. I thought he was overrated last year. It was not a problem for me not to vote for him for Horse of the Year, because I felt that he's a horse that has to have it his own way, and if he doesn't, he just doesn't fire.
Yeah, fair enough. So the question I'll put to both of you, Pete, you could start first. There's been a little bit of talk, and I don't think it's anything real, but some people have said maybe they should geld him and make him a Game On Dude. Maybe that will help, and it certainly would lengthen his race career. From a pedigree standpoint, obviously he's not a monster, but anything that he would get attention-wise at stud would be based on that race career, which both of you have certainly brought into question. And so the question would be for breeders, what sort of value would you put on Byron as a stud, and is his potential future maybe better as a gelding on the racetrack?
I think that's insane to me. I think that breeders and in the bloodstock market, I'm talking here as just a handicapper guy hanging out, talking about racing when I'm being a little harsh on the horse. His Woody Stevens really was awesome. Here you have a horse that won a grade two, I guess the Stevens is, at six, and then all the way out to 10 furlongs in the Breeders' Cup Classic. On your catalog, on your page, at the sales, you know, that's what you're going to see. You're going to see all that impressive graded form and black type. And I've just got to think that's going to be worth more in aggregate than what you can make racing him. Because, yeah, you know, he might respond to gelding, but he might not. And then all of a sudden you've turned something, an asset worth something, into nothing. That sounds a little loopy to me.
Okay.
I agree. I think he definitely should be going to stud. He has great value. He's a multiple graded stakes winner. He's won from seven furlongs to a mile and a quarter. You know, that's, again, like Pete was saying, that's what they say on the page. And actually, I do think, just because he needs the lead to win doesn't mean he's not a good racehorse and mm-hmm. won't make a good stud. Mm-hmm. I think he actually might make a very good stud because he has speed. He was precocious, and he's the type of horse that would make a good stud. You get him with the right mare. I mean, you're not going to give his heart.
Yeah.
You know, you're giving his ability. And that's, you know, it's just a personality thing maybe where he needs the lead. But his talent, I don't think there's any question about how talented the horse is.
Oh, absolutely. I just wonder where he'd be able to stand and for how much. You know, as a sire of sires, I don't know. Wildcat Era was certainly a good value sire, but I don't know if he's one that people are going to be looking to as a sire of sires, but you're right. I mean, sometimes the ability on the racetrack just trumps all of that.
Well, he's going to start in New York and Kentucky, I'm sure. But if he ended up in New York with this program they have here, you know, he could stand for a decent amount, and he could probably be a very successful sire.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to the race. It was won by Catch a Flight, Pete. That was your pick. Ended up being a relatively square price, considering Opportunity took a lot of money as well, and. You know, Catch a Flight, certainly, whether it was a little bit of a move too early last time by Gary Stevens, or, you know, maybe even sort of the classic bounce, either way, he stepped forward. I think he will be and should be a fine player in the older classic division. I think there's still some good things to come from that horse. Pete, what was your take?
Yeah, Stevens even said after the last race that he wanted a do-over. I think there's no question that the horse moved too soon and things just went all wrong last time. And I think this time, you know, Gary got his do-over and he made the most of it. And I think he showed something a lot closer to who that horse truly is. Do we have a speed figure yet for that race, Mike?
Oh, we probably do. I just hadn't looked. Okay, you want to pull it up while we're... Yeah, I'm sure there's a speed figure for all these races. I hadn't done that little bit of homework. I'd watched them all again, but
No, I agree. I think Catch a Flight, he got a good trip,
and he
got a good ride from Gary Stevens, and I think he's definitely proven that he could be a player in the division. I don't think there's any question about that.
And the other story is Appealing Tail. You know, he ran a bang up race, considering he was dueling with Byron pretty much the whole way. Ended up it's not like Byron finished out of the money. He did finish a decent third, which for many people who consider him either a win or run out horse, you know, hey, he hit the bottom rung of the try. But Appealing Tail on the stretch out, you know, he was also cross-entered to the Bing Crosby the next day.
They made the right choice.
They decided to go there.
Yeah.
He ran a huge race.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? He might have been able to win the Bing Crosby the way it went.
You never know.
But that said, I mean, stretching him out is probably better for him now. It gives him the more choices. And like you said, he ran a good race and got a nice little piece of the pie.
Yeah. All right, well, let's jump back to Saratoga. We had another race on Saturday, the Grade 3 Sanford Stakes for two-year-olds. And that was a relatively controversial result. The winner was Magnolite, or at least the first to cross the finish was Magnolite, was DQ'd to place third, and Todd Pletcher's Uncle Vinny ended up the mutual winner as well as the one that took down the top prize in terms of the purse. Big run from my pick, Percolator, who ended up finishing third, elevated to second. Cold consolation for my win wager and my double to him from him to hard not to like. But, you know, he ran well.
He did.
Thoughts on the race, Lonnie?
I thought that obviously it's the most controversial race of the weekend, mm-hmm. given the fact that there was the DQ. And it's funny because I was moving forward in my picks with that, and I did not have Magnolite. So from an emotional point of view, you know, I was thinking, oh, man, I hope they take him down. But mm-hmm. when I first look at it, I thought there's no way they're going to take this horse down because he was clear. But then when they show it again, he comes in. I say, okay, he did interfere with Uncle with the inside horse, which was Percolator, who probably ran the second best race there, actually. He interferes with Percolator, and then I'm thinking, you know something? They probably should take him down. And, you know, I think Magnolite ran the best race, the real best race sure. there. But it's just unfortunate. I mean, they're young horses. They could bolt like that. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think he was going to the whip too much. It just, the horse reacted.
It just happened. Pete, yeah. what's your take on it?
Very similar to Lonnie. When I saw the replay and saw the first incident when the horse sort of shies from the whip and comes out four paths very, very dangerously, that to me wasn't enough to say for sure the Percolator was cost a placing. Percolator does this little like kind of like dip of the head move, but the jock never stops riding. And so when I thought that was the only incident, I was thinking this is a terrible DQ. The winner was much the best. But just like Lonnie, watching it again and watching then how after he bolts out, he comes back in and bothers Percolator again, you got to think about what the rules are. I know it stinks to have a horse who's five lengths the best in the race have to get DQ'd. I wish we were in a world where the jockey could get the days. I believe, maybe in my one disagreement with Lonnie, I kind of believe he deserved the days mm-hmm. That he got.
That's what
that.
I said too. Yeah.
Part of me wishes you could get the days and the result stands. But that's not the way the rules are written. The way the rules are written is, does the incident cost a horse a placing? Given the final margin between Uncle Vinny and Percolator, and given the not one but two incidents that the winner, that the first across the wire caused, I think they had no choice but to DQ the horse. And I'm actually very surprised to see even many of our DRF colleagues on Twitter still saying why they don't understand why it was a DQ. I think according to the way the rules are written, it has to be a DQ, but I think we can all acknowledge and have empathy for how much it stinks to have a horse who's five lengths the best, but the rules say you got to come down.
Actually, you also have to give John Velasquez credit for continuing to ride Uncle Vinny.
Oh,
He got him. He got him second there. Where actually, what we're talking about, the costing of the placing is Percolator was interfered with to finish second. And you know, if Velasquez says, okay, I got third here, and he wraps it up at all.
Yeah.
He's not going to get there and ultimately, you know, winning that race.
Right. Yeah. If Johnny V doesn't ride on, there's no DQ. Although
I agree.
Although, when I first saw the race live, and when I first saw the initial inquiry, I was not listening. I often will watch races, both replay and live, without the audio. Partly because I don't want to, in my handicapping or my assessment of the race, be swayed by the race caller's view of how the race is shaping out. I want to see what I'm seeing without being biased, I guess. And when I initially saw the replay, and even when I saw it live, what I saw was Percolator reacting to Magnolite coming over and actually coming in on the six. He's coming in hot and maybe bothering that horse a little bit. So when they were first reviewing it and I saw that there was an inquiry, I was expecting actually Magnolite to be placed behind the six because I saw it as a bit of a chain reaction. So I was a little surprised to see him placed behind Percolator. Because I thought that the one that might have, if you made a case that even though he was clear, the sudden movement made the jockey react and then caused him to steady, which actually caused him to go over into the inside horse, you could also make a case that the one who was also cost a placing was the six horse. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
I didn't see it that way as much. I mean, he actually did. It's possible that you go that deep, but you know, given that it's a graded stakes and it is a big kind of breeding race when you go, just to call back that, I think that the direct interference really was with Percolator when he came in? Because, again, it was really subtle, but it was a slight bump, which I think just cost him momentum. I don't think he's coming in hot, was really going to come up to fourth. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I'd have to look at that again because I was really not focusing on the inside horse.
Sure.
But I thought the horse most affected was Percolator because he seemed to have the most momentum. I mean, he was a real danger in the mm-hmm. lane. And you know, he was the horse that I think, not when he went out, but when he came back in, he physically bumped him and definitely stopped his momentum. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was the horse I thought that would directly be affected by that.
Pete, any thoughts on that?
I'd have to watch it again. I didn't notice that, but I will say this. If that's what went down, and if the rider of he's coming in hot thought he was cost of placing, he's got to claim foul there.
Mm-hmm. Fair point.
I think to have any chance of that happening.
Fair point. And you know, I say this because I didn't have the audio on, so I didn't know where they were making. I was just watching it. I was doing other things, of course, you know. Got a two-year-old, so I'm not always completely 100% focused. I put my bets in a little early and then just let it all play out. So, and of course, I was focused on my horse, Percolator. So when I saw him come over onto what I saw as him coming over onto he's coming in hot, I thought, uh-oh, perhaps they're going to look at that.
That's interesting. I think I had he's coming in hot as one of my pick four horses. So I think I was looking at him, and come to think of it, it never occurred to me actually that he would because I like you, I'm trying to focus in on the horses that I'm hoping are going to come up and help me move forward with the best possible outcome.
Let's ignore this one in the front and focus on
exactly. So I didn't really see it, but like that, I think I'd have to watch it again. But I didn't see anything.
All right, and let's move on to Sunday's Coaching Club American Oaks. It was another DQ. Another one that in some ways I think was controversial, but for many was less controversial. Curalina is elevated over I'm a Chatterbox. There was a nose separating the two of them. Thoughts on that DQ and that race, Lonnie?
I thought I'm a Chatterbox ran a great race. I've always been a fan of hers. I think the DQ was justified, though, because when you come out like that with that little margin, it probably could have cost her the victory. So I thought I thought they made the right call in that case, but I thought both these horses ran really good races, and I particularly was impressed with I'm a Chatterbox. I mean, she controlled the pace, but she was game late, and she wasn't going to let Curalina pass her.
Pete?
I was actually drawn into betting this race because I originally liked those two. I'd written a little piece for DRF.com, actually, about the race, and you know, was just going to go with those two as A's there, and I changed my plan. At first, when the tote board first came up, I'm thinking, okay, pass race for me. They're both too short. I'm a Chatterbox was kind of acting like a maniac in the paddock, and I didn't realize that was her way. She was kicking the stall. She was getting all sweaty. She was just generally speaking, acting like a horse I had no interest in betting on. So I was actually drawn into the race. And to give you an idea of what I thought of the DQ, now, granted, it was biased. You know I'm biased because I just admitted to betting Curalina. But I was so sure it was a DQ, I told some of my buddies who I was sitting with in the paddock bar that if I'm a Chatterbox didn't come down, you wouldn't see me for the rest of the meet because I'd be under arrest for assault steward.
All right. Interesting. You know, it to me it seemed like, you know, sometimes when you see horses that are tiring late, they have a little bit of a lead. Sometimes the jockey, and whether it's intentional or not, sometimes the horse, when they get a little weary, they might move a little like that. But it's almost like the bump and explode, where a little bump can sometimes put a little extra, you know, it almost gets the horse back into the bridle a little bit. And that's sort of what I saw there. It's in some ways a little similar to She's a Tiger and Rhea Antonia in the juvenile fillies a couple years ago, where it was almost that same sort of thing in a very short margin, and you know it was one of those where I think that was absolutely the right call, you know, but even if it was an intentional thing with the jockey, you never know whether it's actually going to bother the other horse. You never know if it's, you know, you're just trying to get the last little bit of energy out of your mount, and you know, I certainly don't think it was anything intentional. I think it was just you know, had a tiring horse and tried to get the most out, and you know, ended up bumping and bothering the other.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, she ran a good race. I mean, she, you know, again, it's because the margin was so small. I
right.
mean, and since she did come out, she did affect Carolina, and I think that was the call they hit. That was an easy call. I don't think it was all that hard, but not like the day before. This was a very easy call.
Right.
I still think that, and this might be controversial. I think Include Betty is the best horse in that division. I just think she was pace compromised. I think she's been the most impressive so far this year. But in that race, I didn't think she had much of a chance because of the pace.
Yeah, I like her. And you know, boy, a few years ago, had this been a 12 furlong race? You know, I mean, and I tweeted out about it. It's, the Coaching Club American Oaks it's a fine race. It's a fine, you know, $300,000 grade one, but it's as a grade one, it's almost really a prep, you know, and it's a kind of a prep for the Alabama. Mm-hmm. To me, it's lost a little bit of the interest and luster since they shortened it up from 12 furlongs. I don't know, Pete, if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I think that was one of these things where after several years of it being a 12 furlong race and getting shorter and shorter fields and lower buyer speed figures, that they decided to bend what that race used to be to sort of the horses that we breed today, made a little bit of a concession to the breeders on that one and the trainers. So I think that's why that went down. The only other point I'll make about the DQ is I do think there's, like, I know what you mean. It certainly wasn't intentional that the rider, the contact wasn't intentional, but in New York especially, we have established this sort of culture of herding, I've heard mm-hmm. it referred to as, mm-hmm. where it's sort of okay that you can go several paths over to intimidate a horse where you don't, and if you don't make contact, if you don't have the little hip check, they will leave you up here.
Right, yeah.
And I think it's dangerous, man, and I don't like it one bit. I wish, you know, you needed to have that contact for that to be a no-brainer DQ. And to me, I kind of wish they would just get the jockeys in the habit of using their hands and keeping their horses straight in deep stretch instead of seeing these things where, you know, every time I see it, I feel like, you know, we're setting up for something catastrophic to happen. Let's not wait till something catastrophic happens to sort of change this culture and change the way these rules are enforced.
I think that's race riding, but at the same time, If it's to be changed, I think the jockeys are the ones who really have to bring it up because they're the ones who are at most risk, I think, in that regard. And I mean, because they're the ones riding it like that. And, you know, I think the handicappers maybe are, you know, as a New York player, I am used to that. And sometimes I will want to see my jockey do something to maintain his control over the race. Now, if the jockeys think it's dangerous and it's something which is going to, you know, threaten their well-being, then I think it's their job to bring that up.
I mean, I think there's a very fine line.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Pete.
Oh, sorry, Mike. I was just going to say it's hard. I know what you're saying, Lonnie. Like, that makes so much sense. But also that world is so darn competitive that I think it might be one of these things where a dangerous situation is occurring where until something really bad happens, nobody's going to want to be the one to step up and do something about it. I kind of feel like the control, it's such a competitive world that the control has to come from without than within. But you make a great point as well.
I mean, they're the ones in the game. I mean, and if they accept that, I mean, a lot of games are dangerous and, you know, and have that high risk involved. And, I mean, they're the players in that regard in terms of the race riding. And if they've accepted it, that's one thing. But if they feel it's dangerous and if they're bothered by it, then I think that if any changes to be made, they're the first ones that need to be, you know.
Couldn't you say, one more thought on this, couldn't you say the same thing about the NFL, though? Like, I'm a huge believer that the head injuries in the NFL are this, like, are this massive problem. I would love to see helmets with padding on the outside, frankly. Anything to make it so these guys don't end up having these lives where they're you know, struggling to live normally at age 40 because of the equivalent of having been in, you know, 30 car crashes by the time they're 28. But no football player is going to be the one who comes out and says, oh, this is the way it's going to be while they're playing. You don't want to sort of break ranks. You don't want to be the agitator. I sometimes feel that these kind of changes, especially when safety's involved, should come from the outside. I mean, I take your point. I respect it completely. And I'm not saying I'm definitely right. I just want to throw that out there that sometimes I think it's very difficult for the athletes competing directly against each other to like think of their own safety like that. I just don't think it's the way that their brains work. They're just so competitive. They're not looking at the big picture like that.
Well, football players have a players association, which at least they have a venue by right. which to address it. I mean, even if the jockeys wanted to, I don't know if there's an organized body that could actually, you know, bring the point up. I mean, it'd be interesting to know how they feel about that. But it's something which, if they had a forum in which they could have an organized voice to express their concerns about racing, that might be helpful.
It's a great point.
NFL, they have that.
Yeah, and, you know, I was going to say there's a fine line between race riding and fouling, you know, and sometimes it's circumstantial. You know, you might be slightly clear or more clear, but you're trying to herd and you don't actually make contact versus, you know, and so to Pete's point, I think, and even going back to the Sanford, Magnolite, I don't, obviously he shied from the horse and or from the whip, and that was a sign of a very green young two-year-old. But at the same time, when you go a really strong left-handed whip when you're that late against with a tiring horse, a jockey, especially with a young two-year-old, can foresee the possibility of coming across lanes, mm-hmm. you know, and whether he expected it to be that extreme, you know, and that's why I was thinking like Pete, I figured he's going to get days for it, because you can imagine something like that happening. God forbid he wasn't clear. You know, you could have a catastrophe, right?
Well, you should have rules perhaps against excessive whipping, particularly with 2-year-olds. I mean, with a horse that's green, I mean, they have it abroad.
Yeah.
You know, where you can't whip a horse excessively. You can only whip them X amount of times in the stretch or something like that. And we don't have anything like that here. And it might be a good time to do something like that. I mean, this was a case. Now, here's where you have an example of a case where maybe the horse, because of the reaction to the whip, you know, overreacted. It could have been, like Pete said earlier, it could have been catastrophic if horses were in the lane where she bolted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, well, let's move on. This is obviously a topic for discussion and probably throughout the summer. I can't imagine we won't have any other controversial DQs or non-DQs to discuss. So I'm sure we'll be bringing this up more. But it's, you know, it's a tough spot for the stewards. I think it's... they're almost always going to be criticized no matter what they do. So I'll let that be the last point on it. Let's move on. We had some discussion on Twitter. I think it would be good. It's really hard to answer certain questions in 140 characters. So I thought it would be a good time and place to have a discussion about multi-race wagers, about using tools like Ticketmaker, the whole A's, B's, and C's system. There are some people that believe, you know, I don't like the A's, B's, and C's because it opens you up for the possibility of having some horses on one ticket and not on another, and having horses on multiple tickets where you cash nothing. But I wanted to get you guys' take on how you use a tool like Ticketmaker, how you approach multi-race wagers with Ticketmaker, and even just when you like to bet on multi-race wagers and when you prefer to stick either with win, place, show, exacta, try, even superfecta wagers. Pete, you wanna start with it?
Absolutely. Generally speaking, I really like multis on the big days. I find myself over the years looking back at my performance, and I just do better in higher quality races. You know, and I do better in route races for whatever reason, though okay in higher class sprints. So I'll just look for sequences that comprise the types of races I like to bet, and that's usually when I'll focus in on multis. Or if I'm handicapping an entire card and I just happen to notice that I have maybe two strong opinions in a pick three sequence or a pick four sequence. And that strong opinion, that can be liking a horse. Either maybe it's a shorty who I think is absolutely stone cold single, or maybe it's a key horse at a nice price, or, and this is sometimes the best of all, it's a shorty who you can oppose, a horse who you can just say, you know what, if this one wins, I lose. You know, Byron comes to mind. I was deep in the throes of barbecuing and partying with my Saratoga pals when that race was going on, so I did not, I was not playing multis, but like that's the kind of race I could say, you know what, I'm going to target around this because I've got a strong A in Catch a Flight and I've got a short priced horse I can absolutely toss. So in terms of the types of situations I'm looking to isolate, those are the factors.
Yeah, I normally, since I usually try to keep notes on most horses in my circuit, I'm looking for horses to come back. If they're running in the sequence of the picks, and these days there's picks everywhere, mm-hmm. I'm going to try to single to them so I don't have to do a win bet. If it's a pick four and they're in the middle of the sequence, I'll single through them. Mm-hmm. You know, single sure. to them or single through them. And again, like with Pete, I'm going to throw out a favorite if I can. If I can get a short price off the ticket completely, I'm going to be real happy because you're guaranteed to, it's going to be much easier to make a profit, I should say. Right. Now, in terms of the overall, you know, you were bringing up the point with the A's and the B's and the C's, and that's something I think you have to use Ticket Maker more to actually determine what works best for you and determine what the A's are. I mean, A is obviously a horse you like a lot, but there might be another horse that you think is a strong possible winner in there, and you don't want to not use it as an A, in the possibility that it might like cost you a nice score. So I think you have to decide who you think is the most likely winners and what the prices are. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's a short price horse, and I think the sequence is going to be short, and you know, I'm thinking, well, maybe I could catch the short price horse with a long shot along the way, but I'm not crazy about the short price horse. I'm probably not going to use him as an A mm-hmm. if I don't think he's the most likely winner, but I think he's a possible winner. Mm-hmm. In that case, I'd probably use him as a B. Mm-hmm. And now a C is probably a horse I would use who's maybe the kind of horse that I think is going to, he's a possible winner, but not the most likely winner, and he's a good price. And I'd like to have him mixed up with my A somewhere, so I'd make him a C.
Right. Yeah, and I think part of it for me, my approach is, like you were saying, Pete, I often like to... I usually have to have multiple opinions within the sequence in order for me to be enticed. And it usually involves a horse that I like, and then another horse in another leg that I don't, that is likely going to take significant money, either the favorite or the second choice. So I will build my sequences around those, and the one that I think is vulnerable that takes money, I'm happy completely to leave off. Not even as an A or a B or a C. Sometimes I might use extremely defensively only as a C if I've got larger prices in the other sequence, because I don't want to be right in the one leg and then just be so stubborn that I miss out entirely. But some of it depends on value. And again, it goes back to a question of value. And part of this discussion came out of someone on Twitter yesterday. I tweeted out a play where I used a 12-1 second-time starter who had taken money first out and shown speed before tiring in the debut, was 12-1 in this race. I used him as an A along with another horse. And the favorite, who was 0-7 lifetime and dropping from maiden special weight, I used as a B and ended up going off at 6-5 or 7-5. And this guy asked, you know, why would you use a 12-1 as an A, but the 5-2 morning line favorite, 6-5 in live betting, as a B? And my short answer on Twitter, and it was a little flip answer, was, well, because 12-1 pays better than 5-2, you know. But the larger point being, it's where you want to find value. And if your goal is in every multi-race wager to always cash the ticket regardless of the payout, then you might approach it a little differently from me, where my goal is to try and maximize my value, and the way I maximize my value is playing against favorites in a sequence that I don't think are the most likely winner, or I think are potentially quite vulnerable.
Well, you know something, you could actually determine the value, because particularly if you're moving forward, and if it's a pick four, you're seeing what the next leg pays with the double in the probables. Mm-hmm. And when you're looking at that, that gives you an idea if this 5-2 is undervalued or if the 12-1 is being bet right, you know. So if you're 5-2 with the horse in the next sequence is paying like $7, I agree with you. I at the very best, I'm going to make it a B. I mean, it depends.
Yeah.
Unless I have a real long shot moving forward, I'm going to be losing money if I'm not looking ahead at the
right.
in the doubles.
Right.
I mean, with the 12-1, I'm pretty sure. But I'm going to look at the doubles anyway, because they still might be overbetting the second sequence. So before I even think about the pick three or pick four, I'm looking at what the double probables are, because that's going to help me in determining the value
right.
of the horse in this first leg.
Right. And sometimes even in later legs, you have to extrapolate what you expect the value to be, because you don't know the third or fourth leg of the pick four. But often with horses like that, a 6-5 in the opening leg, unless I've got a really strong opinion in the later sequences, I will often either use that horse as a lone A, and then the other horses in the race defensively, or I will use as a B or lower. I rarely will use a 6-5 as an A with other A's in that leg, if that makes sense. Because what you're doing is you're increasing your bankroll, you're increasing your budget on that race, and you're opening yourself up to the possibility of landing on the shorter priced horse. It's kind of like when people will go all. That assumes that they really don't like the favorite. Because if you go all and you land on the favorite, then, you know, that's a worst case scenario. Pete, your take on any of that?
I like what you're saying about being very conscious of using a short priced A with other horses. And for me, though, that's one of the areas where I try to use Ticketmaker to help me construct the base of my ticket, but where I try to go beyond Ticketmaker and do some manual work. I'll sometimes have some A's that I kind of circle because I know I need to have that combination more than the other A's. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's because that horse is really like an A plus that I love, but right. Sometimes it'll be because I've got really strong, what I feel are good opinions in the other legs. I think this horse is a super likely winner, and I just don't want to be in a position where if it wins, I'm going to be sort of betting against myself. So I'll let Ticketmaker construct the ticket for me, but then I'll know with this short-priced A, or maybe I have three A's in the race, if the one who I project is going to be 6-5 wins, I need to have that three times as many times as I have that 8-1 A that I have, so I can make sure to maximize my opinions in the other races. And I think that Ticketmaker, you mentioned before, Mike, you made another good point about some people saying, well, I don't want to put in multiple tickets where maybe I'll have each horse that wins, but not on the same ticket. First of all, I think if you really want to be successful long-term, that's the kind of thing you just have to learn to deal with. You can't play multis trying to cash everyone. You mentioned that idea before, and I think some people do think of it that way, mm-hmm. but it's an incorrect thought process. You've got to be looking to pay combinations. You've got to be looking to play combinations that are going to pay, that are going to have a shot at making you some money in the long run. But depending on what bet it is and what size your bankroll is, you can always augment in your multis with doing some sort of caveman ticket for 50 cents as a base. So you have everything tied together. If you've got a lot of fuzzies, if you think the favorites are weak, but then go in and use Ticketmaker and hit the horses you really, really like extra times. I'm not opposed to the idea of ever playing a caveman ticket. I just think they have a time and a place and you have to use them accordingly.
Yeah, and you make a very strong point about not all A's are created equal. Sometimes there are A's that you really want to press a little heavier. And if I have strong opinions, there's no reason why I don't do multiple ticket maker plays. Mm-hmm. You know, I might do one where I've got two A's or three A's in one leg and then build it out. And then I do another where if there's an 8-1 that I think is really live, I'll do a second play where I do a lone A and no other horse in that race with the other legs. You know?
Well, the beauty of Ticketmaker is the fact that the A's are the horses that should reflect your best handicapping opinion. And in that regard, if you're stuck with one of these tickets that you have horses that are not and you're not cashing, the thing is, you're committing to your A's. So your belief system is that no matter what, if you have multiple A's that win, these other horses are going to cash with Ticketmaker, I mean, mm-hmm. for the most part. So the beauty of Ticketmaker is it does separate in your mind who you feel the top contenders in each leg is going to be. If you're right about these top contenders, you're going to cash your ticket. For the ticket you don't cash, it's like, you know, you might have had an opinion where you moved an A to a B. In some cases, you have to do that. It's mm-hmm. like Peter's saying, it's just the nature of the game.
Right.
I mean, you could make your adjustments to it if you want to. You could review your tickets if you have the time, because a lot
right.
of times you do it, there's 20 seconds to post. But that said, the beauty of Ticketmaker is that the A's reflect your handicapping opinion towards those particular races in the sequence.
Right.
And then if your belief is borne out in the results, you know, and if you have a horse that's a C, it's going to be there if your A's or other A's are correct. So right. So the thing is, it kind of streamlines your opinion and it gets you right on track as to where you want to be.
Right. Yeah, and that's a good point. I will sometimes move an A to a B if the price is lower. I will rarely move an A to a B if I'm getting 10 or 15 to 1 on them and I think is should be a lower price. Those are the kinds of A's I love to use. Let me ask real quick, what is your approach and how do you differentiate in your mind the difference between an A, what an A looks like, what a B looks like, and what a C looks like?
To me, an A is a horse that I really like, a horse that I think is the most likely winner in my mind, and that, you know, I don't want to leave off the ticket in regards to moving forward. But again, there's also the value factor. If I don't feel I'm going to get paid, and again, one other thing about looking at the value is besides looking forward to the probables, look at the will pace to your horse. Mm-hmm. If there's will pace to it, it gives you an idea sequentially as to how your horse is valued in the multiple win exotics. Mm-hmm. So that's another tool you could use in formulating your ticket. But as far as formulating my A's, it's a horse I have to believe in, and it's a horse that I believe has a good chance of winning. A B is a horse that I might want to use in the exacta, and it's a horse that I might let beat me. It's like you're saying, I'm going to let this horse beat me. I know he's a contender, and I have to use him in the multiple win exotics. And in so doing, I don't believe in him enough to make him an A, so I'll make him a B. And like I said before, with the C is probably the long shot type of play, who I think has a chance, and I don't want to not use the horse. And if I'm right about my other A's, be them two or three in a pick three or pick four, I don't want to not have that horse. Mm-hmm. But he's probably... He probably has like a 10 to 20% chance maybe of winning or maybe even less, but I like him for some reason. I think maybe it has to do with the dynamic of the race. Maybe the race might break down, he might win, but I think there's a reason why he might move up, and I don't want to not use him because in combination with my A's, if I have him, I can make a score.
Pete, what's your approach?
I like a lot of the stuff Lonnie was saying about how to do that. The only thing I'll add is I wouldn't be afraid to make some of those live long shot types that, you know, maybe that I used to put more regularly as C's. I try not to be afraid to make those horses A's. And what I can do to determine when to do that, again, it comes back to the overall race outlook. If it's a race where I'm expecting a price to come in, where I think the favorites are weak, where I might not have them on my ticket, or I have them at best as a B or a C, and I think it's likely for a price, I won't hesitate to put four or five A's, and some of these A's are just different big long shots because I think the favorites are so darn weak. I agree with Lonnie completely. I typically use the B spot in a defensive way for maybe some of those favorites who I want to have plenty of combinations alive with, but I don't really like, but I will sometimes make those horses C's too. It's one of these things, there's no hard and fast rules. It's a lot of going by feel and writing a bunch of tickets. And some of the best advice I've ever received about this, it takes a lot of discipline to do it. But if you really want to get good at constructing these tickets, play on paper. You know, mm-hmm. Newer fans especially shouldn't hesitate to go through the exercise of letter grading every horse in the race, taking a look, whether it's using Ticketmaker or doing it manually, of what your tickets are going to look like. And over time, you sort of develop a feel for you, for which horses are A's, B's, and C's. And for me, it's evolved over time, and I imagine it's going to continue to evolve. But one thing I'll say is, rather than looking at this exercise in isolation, is trying to look at the whole sequence and sequences where you're expecting a big payout or a small payout based on the overall sequence of races, and then adjusting based on that. I mean, just to oversimplify, since I used a lot of words there, to try to condense what I was saying there, if it's going to be a chalky sequence and that's what you think it's going to be, don't look to play a lot of combinations. Either don't play it or play your best combinations hard. If you can beat four favorites, if you can be looking at a potential $20,000 pick four sequence, don't be afraid at all to upgrade some of those long shots, play a lot of combinations, and really go for the gusto. Adjust the way you approach writing your tickets to the situation. The more the tickets you write reflect the opinion that's in your heart of a given race or a given sequence, the more ahead of the game you're going to be. That's the goal of bet writing. It's to come up with a numerical expression of your handicapping opinion.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said that better. So I'll just add the way I look at C's, because C's I think are controversial for a lot of people. And even those that use Ticketmaker, there are many that refuse to play C's because I guess the logic being, and some people approach it the way you mentioned, Lonnie, which is this crazy long shot that they don't want to get beaten by. You know, we'll use Kelly's prize as the example on opening day, where you just can't really see it on paper, but you want to be protected from chaos. I'm not saying that's not a good way to approach it. I don't necessarily approach it that way. I might. Some of it has to do with the way I use C's is I use them very defensively. And I might do, for instance, in Naira and in Southern California as well, the late pick four is often three good races in the first three legs, and then either a bottom level maiden claimer or a bottom level open claimer where it's really hard to make a case for standing strong on one individual horse. And if you do, that horse is likely to be a short price anyway. So if I've got strong opinions in the first three legs, whether they're chalky or not, I might use that last leg, depending upon my budget, as my A's, B's, and then the rest of the field as C's. So that if I'm right in the first three legs with my A's, I've gone all in the last leg. You know, that's a good use of the, but it's not a straight all in the caveman way. It's an all in the, if I'm right with my stronger opinions, then I'm covered. I'm covered, I'm protected from chaos. And that's usually how I like to use C's. Like, for instance, last week I was in, Pete, you said you did a how you'd play Saratoga on Sunday. I was assigned with how I'd play Del Mar on Thursday, and I approached the first three races where I was all about beating a Baffert two-year-old dropping from maiden special weight into maiden claiming. So I tossed, in my pick three play that I posted on DRF.com, I tossed that 3-2 favorite completely. The horse ended up running second, could have won, but from a multi-way race standpoint, I was willing to take a stand against because I knew if I beat that short price, it just increases the payoffs of all the other ones. And luckily, I caught a first-time starter as a C in that first race. Peter Yurton won at odds of 4-1, but I think he was something like 1-43 with two-year-olds in the last 5 years. Lorse was working well. Trainer didn't seem like, you know, he does well with these sorts of things. But I wanted to protect from the possibility that this one might be live, so I threw in as a C. That's how I use C's a lot of the time. Ones that I would likely leave off if I was just doing a caveman ticket. But the nice thing about Ticketmaker is you have the ability to add them in strictly defensively.
I would never have used Kelly's prize as an A, B, C, or D. Let me make that perfectly clear. Actually, a lot of times I will use as A's horses that are very long, but what I think the chances of the horse is winning and the odds are not always the same. I mean, sure. A 10-1 horse to me might be a horse that I love. It might be 2-1. It's a solid A. If you could get one sequence where you have just one or two A's, then you could spread much more liberally with the other sequences in the pick three or pick four, particularly in the pick four, where you again, the budgetary concerns then become an issue. So, like, there was the very first day at Saratoga in the first leg of the pick four, I basically had two A's, and it gave me the flexibility to actually go deeper in the mm-hmm. other legs. And you know, and the two A's finished first, second, and they were both like a decent enough price. My only problem was I wasn't able to get the ticket.
Yeah.
Well, sure. I wasn't able to play the ticket.
Sure.
But it paid like $1,100 and still was a 15 or 20-1 off my investment, which is good, which is what you want. That's why you play these things.
You make a good point about judging your A's. And for me, the way I like to think of it, and there's not a solid, it's like you said, Pete, it's a little by gut. But what I like to do with my A's is, it's a term I've never even used, I just came up with right now, almost like a value delta, mm-hmm. where if I've got a horse, even if I don't think they're the most likely winner, I might think, and I'll use an example of Take Charge Brandy in Breeders' Cup Day. She is a horse I think maybe was 8-10% chance of winning. But at 60-1, that value delta meant I had to elevate her to an A, you know. I still am expecting she's not going to win because I think she's, you know, got a 9-10 chance of losing. But when I'm getting six times my expected value for that horse, to me, that's easy enough to elevate that horse to an A.
Well, he brings up the race shape could totally, you know, sure. It could color your ticket. If you see a possible low in speed, in a pace challenge race, you have to elevate those horses into prominent spots in your ticket. Yeah. And Take Charge Brandy is the perfect example.
Yeah. Pete, any other thoughts before we wrap it for the day?
I love what Lonnie said about using the race shape to guide your tickets. Some players will create multiple tickets for different scenarios. In other words, let's say there's a dirt race that has three strong, or two strong front runners and two strong closers in it. Maybe do one set of tickets where the race stays together on the front end, and in that sequence, you're only using those two horses, and then do a whole different sequence where you're projecting that pace is gonna melt down, and you use the closers. You can do the same thing in exacta bets and trifecta bets as well, where you sort of look at different scenarios that might happen. You can really take this stuff to the next level. This mm-hmm. has been a really fun conversation, but we're just barely scratching the surface. So if folks have more questions, feel free to reach out to us on Twitter. We'd be happy to keep the conversation going.
Love it. Yeah, and that's what I do sometimes with my A's. You know, if I'll use two A's, and I did it in that Del Mar sequence in the third race on Thursday. It looked like it had a lot of early speed. And my two A's were the one that I thought might be the fastest of the early speed, and then the one that I thought might benefit most from a ridiculously fast early pace that really upgraded closers. And so that's often how I do it, because you can handicap on paper and you say, wow, every one of these horses needs the lead, but there might be just one that ends up running them off their heels, or the jockeys see that and they get tentative and one of them takes advantage of that. So you wanna be able to construct your wagers based on how you see races shaping up, and I love the idea of doing two approaches, one if the race works out this way, one if it works out another way.
Actually, that brings up the point of another way to come up with C's is if the race is completely going to break down. And that's where your C all button, so to speak, comes in.
Sure.
It's for the race breakdown.
Well,
and that's, use Giacomo in the Kentucky Derby as an example, a couple of derbies where the horse just benefited from horses that just stopped.
Yeah,
they just tired.
You see it in those last races at Santa Anita or at Belmont Saratoga, Southern California or Naira. You know, you'll get in the last leg a legitimate horse who's from class, form, pace, everything has a huge edge, but is taking a big class drop. Maybe hasn't worked in the last few weeks, and it's kind of a question of if he runs his race, he's your winner. If he doesn't run his race, anything can happen, and I want to make sure that I'm covered because that's where you get your prices.
Chaos.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike, the cable guy's here.
Hey. All right. Good timing.
That's
all right,
really
Pete.
Good, actually.
Well, with that, I will hand it off to you.
May you win all your photos.